Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for March 25th.
That's the wrong day, sorry.
I thought, boy, time's flying really fast. It is March 20th. For folks in the audience, I just want to let you know that we are going to finish up a hearing that we had on Monday that we did not finish up. So we have folks who signed up for that. I'm going to ask people to limit their testimony for the Senate Bill 488 to 2 minutes, to be fair. That's what we limited testimony to on Monday. And so I'm going to start calling up the witnesses for that. And after we close that public hearing, we will move to Senate Bill 790. And we have sign-up sheets over there. If you have not signed up, there's extra sheets still over there. And please make sure if you've come over 100 miles to mark it off, because we will call you up first. We want to make sure you get heard initially. So with that, we will go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 488. And Beth, why don't you remind the committee what the bill does?
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 488 repeals the sunset on provisions related to the low carbon fuel standard.
Okay, thank you. And we were in the middle of a hearing when we ran out of time on Monday, so we're going to continue down the list. I'm going to call up panels in the order that they were signed up. So first we have
Gary Campbell.
Gary?
Craig?
No, it's Craig Campbell.
Oh, Craig Campbell.
Craig Campbell? Okay, no, Craig. Yes. You're double dipping if you come up again.
Actually, Casey couldn't be here. He asked me to turn in the written testimony.
All right, thank you. So we'll cross him off. Frank Holmes, is that right? I'm having a hard time reading the handwriting.
Frank's not here today.
Okay, well, we're whipping right through that. Paul Romaine, I know you're here. Katie Fast and Ron
Bennett.
Okay, can you cross him off for me, please? All right. Thank you for coming back. Katie, you want to get started?
Sure. Yep. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau opposes Senate Bill 488 and has concerns about the removal of the sunset. The 2009 legislation that implemented the rulemaking authority at DEQ for the low carbon fuel standard placed a sunset on it. So the legislature continued to have oversight on the impacts that the program would have on fuel users. Currently, we do not have the final implementation rules ready and believe that that sunset should remain so that the legislature can continue to have reviews and oversight on the program. From a fuel user's perspective, agriculture does take quite a bit of diesel to grow food and fiber. And we are concerned from a farmer's perspective on what the price impacts of the program are going to be, and that we don't have adequate assurances that the off-ramps that are being discussed are going to provide those protections. Also, I'd like to touch on another piece of the 2009 legislation that created some exemptions for farm trucks and farm implements. You know, the problem with that exemption and the time we opposed the bill when it was being introduced is our fuel for agriculture is not segregated from the regular fuel source. So the exemption doesn't really work for farmers because we buy our fuel from Paul Romaine's clients that are selling to a multitude of clientele. So when fuel comes into Oregon, it's not designated just for agriculture. And we don't believe that is a legitimate exemption to protect our industry. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions.
Great. Thank you. Why don't we go to the next panelist, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Bennett. I'm employed by Hamilton Construction Company. We're a Springfield, Oregon-based contractor, founded in 1939, working in a majority of the western U.S. building bridges. We employ about 170 people. I'm also a board member of the Associate General Contractors, Oregon Columbia chapter, and for the record, the agency opposes the bill. I believe you have a copy of their position.
Thank you.
My real purpose here today is to provide a perspective on how users like us, who are dependent on Oregon's fuel supply, would be impacted by eliminating the sunset clause on a low-carbon fuel standard clean fuel program, as proposed. As bridge builders, we have a substantial amount of heavy equipment, cranes, forklifts, generators, welders, heavy trucks. I thought a good way to illustrate this would be the results of a EPA clean diesel pilot project that my company volunteered for several years back. Having talked to our fleet manager, I've got some results. Applying that project to our entire fleet of 20 cranes, we would spend up to $100,000 per unit to retrofit, and for the other 80 pieces of equipment in our fleet, we'd spend up to $50,000 per unit. Obviously, this is a lot of money, and that's just the initial capital investment. What would the permanent operating costs be going forward? We believe the cost to be quite significant, especially when you consider the bill affects a large portion of our equipment. Currently, however, it's impossible to calculate the exact cost with any degree of certainty. Another unpredictable cost is the impact on equipment depreciation and its effect on our balance sheet and financial statements. Negative implications do not go over well with surety companies or banking relationships. In closing, I want to be clear that our company is not opposed to alternative fuel for carbon reduction. In the near term, however, we do not see that engine technology is currently available, nor the quantity or quality of fuel commercially and is consistently available, especially in the multi-state regions that we work in. Our industry in particular needs consistency and predictability to be successful, especially in today's economic environment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Paul? Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. I submitted some testimony for you, and I'll go over that really quickly. First of all, there's some editorials, and this is from the Oregonians for Sound Fuel Policy. There are editorials from the Oregonian, the East Oregonian, and the St. Helens Chronicle opposing the low-carbon fuel standard in 488. There's a slide presentation summarizing some of the problems with LCSF. And there's also an economic report from Charles River Associates, Boston Consulting Group, and Dr. Randy Posdina, which not only back up the cost increases we claim, but also reviewed and critiqued the Jack Fawcett analysis relied upon by DEQ, exposing three major flawed assumptions in the Fawcett analysis. One is abundant cellulosic ethanol, cheaper than gas, and all the biofuels plants are built in Oregon. I just wanted to go through very quickly what this program really is about. It's in previous programs that you've adopted, it's basically been when the fuel's available, you will use it. That's what it was with biodiesel. That's what it was with ethanol. The mandate came in. The fuel was available. We had to use it. The problem with this program is it's premised on the fact that the fuel's not going to be available, because we'd love to have cellulosic ethanol available to blend. The problem is that right now you have 20,000 gallons that have been produced last year. There's absolutely no chance that you're going to get any meaningful amount produced. So what happens is, if we can't meet the blending requirement to drop the carbon content of our fuel, the only thing we can do is buy a credit. And the credit will be available from the state. That's the part of the DEQ rule that they haven't sprung on you yet. The credit will be available. The whole program is based upon us buying those credits so they can have money to put into alternative fuels. So it automatically increases the price of the fuel. We have no choice but to increase the price of the fuel. I see my time is up, unless somebody has any open-ended questions.
Senator Bates. And I'm sure it won't be open-ended.
No, two issues. I'm still troubled by the off-ramps for this if product isn't available. I've been asking that for the last 2 days, and I'm just not getting a clear answer from either proponents or opponents. And I'd like to hear what you think about this. You mentioned it. I'm sorry I came in a few minutes late. You mentioned it. And I also had asked what happens if there's not enough available. And, Paul, you touched that, a part I hadn't heard before also. So first, if you would answer that question as best you can, and I'd like to hear more about the credits, Paul.
So Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, the off-ramp concern that we have is that there has been, for an off-ramp to be triggered. There's been hardship in the market for a certain length of time. And I think since we don't have final rules, you know, you're hearing different time frames, but I think the one thing we'll know is that there is a portion of time where the fuel price has hit a trigger point. The issue with fuel is that distributors have made a purchase on a certain price assumption that they're going to be holding those fuels. So they're going to have a purchase mix that they're still going to have to sell at a certain price. On the other hand, my members also buy fuel in bulk. So you're going to be having farms that have purchased thousands of gallons of fuel that they have in tanks that they purchased potentially at that higher price before the off-ramp triggered. And so, you know, this manipulation of the market that we're looking at creates, you know, a lot of economic uncertainty for fuel users.
Okay, other questions? Senator Olson?
Well, did you have Senator Bates had one for Mr. Romaine, didn't you?
I want to hear what that credit system is.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the system is designed basically, if there's no fuel available to get you below, and I'm talking from a gasoline or diesel perspective, if there's nothing you can blend in that drops that carbon number, then you're not in compliance with the program. So you can either stop selling, or what the program's designed to do is to set up a system where you go through DEQ or some agency and you buy a credit. In other words, it's in effect a fine. You get to buy a credit from them, and that way you are excused from dropping the carbon content. You buy a credit, somebody else gets the benefit of the credit, and it's usually a fuel that will meet the carbon content, like a, you know, whatever happens to be the favorite flavor of the day. But it's designed to have us buy out. If you simply want a mandate to use the fuel, you have it already. I mean, 36 billion gallons of ethanol, half of which is supposed to be, I believe, cellulosic ethanol, or maybe all of it cellulosic ethanol. That's supposed to be the requirement. You can't use that. It's not available. It doesn't exist. There was a lawsuit just recently.
So I'm going to have to cut you off because we're going to be short on time. We have a lot of people here to testify in another bill.
We'll
make sure and have you follow up. Also, DEQ could not be here today, and I want to make sure we hear directly from the agency that will be implementing the program, not the industry, because I think it's important that we hear what the agency has in mind. So did you have a question, Senator?
I have a question for Mr. Bennett, and congratulations on being a large contractor. That's really cool. My concern is that you own 20 cranes and a lot of other heavy equipment, and you do a lot of work around the state and out of state. How do these different fuel blends affect your equipment when you put it to work?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the fuel blends are problematic for numerous reasons. One, they wreak havoc with our fuel filters, and they wreak havoc with our exhaust filters, which, as part of the original pilot project we were part of, it replaced an engine and all of those sources. Our maintenance costs went up. Our fuel costs went up. Primarily because we burn more fuel. These engines aren't as efficient as existing. And the constant maintenance of the filters, both fuel filters and exhaust filters, created a lot of downtime for the equipment, 20% more than normal, I would say. So they are problematic going from state to state, even possibly county to county, depending on what the fuel availability is.
Follow up? So, I understand what you're talking about. I understand the industry. I understand. I've worked on this stuff. For the regular consumer out there, if you bid on a bridge project, you need to increase your overall fuel usage bills to be charged off because of the fact that it's going to take more fuel, and these cranes use an enormous amount of fuel when they're in operation.
Correct.
So this essentially adds cost to building bridges in our state. It adds cost to the state itself because of this mandate.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's very true. It takes away from the hard asset, if you will. It costs more in material to produce the product, and in the end, the end product may have, say, for example, it's a $10 million bridge, and $6 million of it is the hard cost of the bridge. That other $4 million is going to be in flux significantly, depending on not just our fuel costs, but all of our subcontractors' fuel costs, our truckers, cement delivery, things like that. So, yes, it's definitely an impact to the ultimate owner as well.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, any other questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much, and thank you for coming back. Appreciate your testimony. We have a few more folks that signed up to testify. David Breen, am I saying that right? David? Spencer Richley, is that right? And Joel Fisher. Welcome. Thank you for coming back. And why don't you go ahead and get started?
Good afternoon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Breen. I'm the Air Quality Program Manager for the Port of Portland. I provided my written testimony, so I'll summarize my comments.
Thank you. The
Port supports Senate Bill 2186 and removal of the sunset provision in Oregon's Clean Fuel Program so the state can continue the momentum towards providing clean fuels to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions from Oregon's transportation fuels. The Port acknowledges that we're headed to a low-carbon future, and as such, the Port has been working for years on a variety of alternative fuel programs. The Port of Portland must look at things in the long term, and by removing the sunset, we believe that the market certainty and stabilization of fuel prices will be enhanced. Oregon's Clean Fuel Program will, first of all, give a boost to the biofuel industry, which is supported by Sustainable Aviation Fuels Northwest and its stakeholders, and provide the incentive for stakeholders in Oregon to keep working to address the challenging issues necessary to guarantee cleaner, low-carbon fuels are widely available. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from Joel, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher. I'm the Senior Policy Analyst at the Oregon Business Association. The Oregon Business Association is comprised of over 300 businesses in Oregon, located from Portland to Boardman, from sizes homegrown to Fortune 500, here to testify in support of Senate Bill 488. I see an Oregon with two potential futures, one where we import our fuels, clean or otherwise, and continue sending money out of state, or one where clean fuels businesses are located here, producing here, employing Oregonians here, and reinvesting our transportation dollars here. I like the second Oregon. The Oregon Business Association sees an opportunity to create that second Oregon, and we aren't asking for any sort of tax credit or subsidy to do it. All we need to do is to lift the sunset on the Clean Fuels Program so that a pragmatic, market-based program, which provides businesses with the market certainty they need to invest, can thrive. Many clean fuels are from renewable sources. Many are also sourced locally. Diversifying our fuel supply with clean fuels such as these will stabilize our already volatile fuel prices and pave the way to a smoother economic recovery through increased economic development in the clean fuels industry. The question I most often get is, why now? The longer we wait, the more likely we are to lose out to other markets. An example is Nike. When Nike emerged as a leader in footwear and apparel, Adidas located its North American headquarters here in Portland. I see a clear opportunity for us to have clean fuels businesses clustered here in Oregon, and the Oregon Business Association urges your support for this program. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these gentlemen? Senator Olson?
Mr. Fisher, you say you want market certainty. Is there ever market certainty for any commodity?
There will be more market certainty if we pass this bill.
There will be more market certainty. So let me ask you another question. It says it's going to stabilize fuel prices. Basically, what we're talking about is ethanol.
We're talking about ethanol. Ethanol is one. Other clean fuels are propane and compressed natural gas.
Which at this time we're not really, and the broad base, are really not prepared to use.
My understanding is that part of the program is credits to convert fleets to those gases.
I'm talking about the consumer. I'm talking about the normal folk that drive their car. They're not prepared to use propane at this time.
No, my understanding is that they would not, but that fleets could be converted.
Follow up. To stabilize the fuel prices, basically, then for the consumer, the normal person, we're talking about driving a car where that's going to have ethanol put in there. And are you certain, and can you confirm today and put on the record that if we have just two ethanol plants in our state, that they will balance out all the fuel ups and downs that we have?
I couldn't say that for certain, but I I could say that we are given increased certainty by diversifying our fuel supply and having fuel that can be sourced here locally as opposed to relying on sources that are just out of state.
One follow-up, because basically this whole argument is about ethanol. We're still going to have to import the gasoline because we don't make any gasoline in our state. So basically what we're talking about is just the additive of ethanol, E10, correct? So we're going to take the ethanol from somebody else, and we're going to supply it instead.
My understanding of the program doesn't run quite that deep.
Pardon?
My understanding of the program doesn't run quite that deep. I think there are some other experts in the audience who could probably answer that question better for
we'll
you.
We'll have somebody else that can come up and answer that.
Thank you. I'm happy to follow
for
up
the
with
question,
you,
Senator.
Thank you.
Later.
Any other questions? I actually have one for the port. I just want to confirm that this the clean fuel standard would not apply to aviation fuel.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both gentlemen for your testimony. We appreciate you coming back today. All right. James Curry and Roger Beyer. Yes, and I'll at the end. Oh, yes. Also, is there anybody else who didn't sign up that would like to come up and testify? Okay. I guess everyone else is here for horses, so you guys are off the hook.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Or bison. Sorry for the bison people. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is James Curry. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Northwest Food Processors Association here in opposition to Senate Bill 488. I've supplied my written testimony for you, but I'd like to highlight just a few of our concerns. And in particular, we're concerned about the impact this has on corn prices. We are generally talking about corn ethanol. It's really the only commercially viable alternative fuel right now that could help reach these standards. And these standards will increase the cost of corn. Diversion of corn from food and feed production to fuel production reduces supply and puts upward pressure on corn prices. Consumers will end up paying more for food due to this diversion and price impact. Corn is used in about 75% of food products on the grocery store shelves. For example, bakery and snack food products, beverage sweeteners, single and multi-ingredient frozen foods, dried form for soup and spice ingredients, and even in livestock feed. Our experience so far with the federal renewable fuel standard has shown distortions in corn prices. In 2011-2012, 40% of U.S. corn crop was converted to ethanol and blended with fuel. 43% of U.S. land originally harvested for crops in 2004 now used for corn ethanol production. And our local poultry processors have seen feed prices increase by as much as 30%. The impact is felt by the dairy, beef, and poultry industries in terms of livestock feed. Higher feed costs drive farm milk prices higher and make domestic dairy products less competitive with foreign imports. Other commodities are also affected. In fact, wheat typically tracks with corn prices, and when corn goes up, wheat follows. So the demand for corn for ethanol pushes farmers to plant more, causing wheat acreage to decline, also affecting supply and price. And worst of all, the impacts are felt most by those least able to afford it. The working poor and folks living on the margins of society are really directly impacted by both food prices and fuel prices. And we believe the low-carbon fuel standard is not an efficient means to achieve lower carbon emissions, and we would urge you not to move forward with the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Roger, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here today to represent the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. The Oregon Dairy Farmers propose that Senate Bill 488 or any other bill that would remove the sunset on the current law. Much of what you just heard about the food processing is why I'm here. The dairy farmers, one of their main feed supplies is corn. What has happened since 2009 for the price of corn, it just about historically doubled. Obviously, all of that can't be attributed to what happened here in Oregon. That's a national issue, and the mandate's nationwide. But even with the economic downturn and the lack of demand for gasoline and fuels nationwide, the historic average of corn prices is still more than double than it was prior to 2009. Again, we can't attribute that only to Oregon's law, but what's happening across the nation with the mandates in other states and from the U.S. Government level. So this has been a disruptor. Our dairy farmers, if you can locate a feeding operation near an ethanol plant, it's not a bad thing because you can use the
byproduct of the ethanol to feed cattle and chickens and other live pigs. But it's very hard to pick up a dairy and move it next to an ethanol plant. In fact, it's next to impossible to do that. And we don't really see ethanol plants getting put where most of the dairies are in Oregon. In fact, they don't even grow very little, if any, corn in the Tillamook area, for instance. So because of those reasons, we are opposed to lifting the sunset and would appreciate this bill not move forward. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for either of the witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much. And we have two last people signed up, Emily Auckland and Jana Gastelum. I hope I got that right.
Good afternoon. Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Emily Auckland. I'm the Environmental Policy Manager at the Association of Oregon Counties.
AOC, can you pull it just a little bit closer? Having a hard time hearing it. Thank you.
AOC supports Senate Bill 488 and the removal of the sunset on the Clean Fuels Program. Counties have been in the loop on this program since the legislation passed in 2009. AOC had a seat on the Low Carbon Fuel Standard Advisory Committee. And now that the program has matured a bit more, counties truly see this as an economic development tool. Counties want to support current and future business investment, particularly in the renewable fuel sector, especially around biomass. The state needs to send a message to the investors that we want them in Oregon. And the current sunset, 2015, is a disincentive. So again, you have my written testimony. I'll just say that AOC supports the removal of the sunset. Thank you.
Thank you. Jana?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council, and we support SB 488. I want to just quickly clear up some things for the record. One, this program is not a fuel mandate. It's not a blend mandate. It doesn't require any additional blending. It does not supersede the state renewable fuel standard. Unblended fuels will still be available. Additionally, the program does not regulate individual fleets or small businesses. And in fact, if a fleet decides to convert, it provides an incentive, an economic benefit, and could enhance the payback period. There is not only one, but three consumer protection measures. The first one actually is a fuel forecasting that looks ahead to make sure that fuel supplies will be available so that we don't even get to a point where there might be any problems with price impacts. This program is supported by over 100 organizations, 75% of which are businesses, but also supported by veterans, consumer advocates, motorists, labor, and health professionals. That list was submitted with my testimony. There will be adequate supply. This program isn't only about biofuels, but there are reports out that do show that there are 165 companies currently working on biofuels that could produce between 1.6 to 2.6 billion gallons by 2015. I'd be happy to supply that report to you as well. But again, this isn't only about biofuels. It's also about propane. It's about natural gas. It's electricity. It's also biogas, which can be created from dairies as well. But there aren't any federal renewable fuel standards for propane, natural gas, or electricity. And that's why this program is unique and necessary. We did hear a little bit about the California lawsuit, and I wanted to quickly address that. It's a lawsuit that's both political and technical, and I can go into those details a bit later, but it only contributes to one small portion of the program, and we believe that the program will continue to move forward regardless of the lawsuit outcome. I think that's all my time, but I'd be happy to take questions.
I was going to say you just missed the hook, so you were lucky. All right, thank you. Any questions for either of these ladies? Senator Olson?
Ma'am, you talk about, we know that electricity and we have electric cars and we know that we have natural gas available. What would be the cost to build the infrastructure for natural gas or propane to drive our cars like you'd pull in any gas station?
So my understanding is that many fleets have converted to propane, and I wish that Blue Star Gas was still here, and they might be able to follow up with you more specifically. But my understanding is the conversion is about $6,000 to convert an existing vehicle to run on propane. The payback period is about 2 to 3 years for that. It does done primarily with fleets. So Franz Bakery here in Salem has done it. The Schwann Company has 6 fleets around Oregon. They've done it. They've been using propane for the last 30 years. They've found incredible cost savings and actually operational savings as well, because propane burns more cleanly, so they don't have to worry about engine wear and tear nearly as much. It's less exhaust, so that when they're in their garages, they find that the people who service those vehicles also like the fuel better.
Follow up.
We talk about fleets, we talk about, and that's wonderful because I've seen that technology. That technology is really cool, and they can pick it up and move it truck to truck. I'm talking about the people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be able to pay $6,000 a car to convert, and if they do, if they can convert it, where do they go get the propane? Is the infrastructure built that they can pull into any gas station and get propane, that they can travel across the United States and get propane? And if that infrastructure is not built and has to be built, how much is that going to add to the cost of propane?
So one of the things... Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the things that we like about the Clean Fuels Program is that it doesn't mandate or dictate any one specific type of fuel has to be used, but rather it lets the market decide the best application for each fuel type. So it's true that different fuels are better for different applications. For consumers, it may be electric vehicles, and we know that electricity is about 1/4 the cost of gasoline, and so there is a great payback period for converting over to electricity. Propane may be better for delivery treats. Trucks. CNG may be better for larger trucks and LNG for long-haul trucks. So the benefit of this type of program is it lets the market sort out the best way to make those reductions. And again, this doesn't apply to every single drop of gasoline or fuel in the state. It's an average. What we want to do is clean up our air, reduce our carbon, and anywhere that that happens is a benefit. So that's why the program is laid out as an average reduction in that fuel intensity. And that's why that credit market works, because you don't necessarily have to blend into every single gallon of gasoline, but if there's a cluster of electric vehicles that happen in a location, those credits can be generated. That reduces the overall average intensity of greenhouse gas emissions, and that's where that lets that market really sort out those solutions.
So basically, then, this is going to be a cap-and-trade market.
No, it's not actually a cap, because it doesn't cap emissions. It actually provides incentives for lower carbon solutions.
So what we're, okay.
Follow up.
We're creating another derivative market to be able to buy and sell credits, energy credits, back and forth.
There is a credit market generated, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Hensel.
Just real quick, you said Schwann did this conversion 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any programs that you were aware of that the state had at that time to incentivize or provide economic security for that investment to them at that time?
I don't know the complete history of the Schwann Company, but I believe they started in the Midwest, so I don't know the history of this.
But here in Oregon?
Here in Oregon.
How long have they converted here in Oregon?
That's a great question. I think we'd have to go back to Schwann and see how long they've been
doing it. You indicated that they'd been doing it for 30 years here in Oregon, because we're talking about Oregonville.
The Schwann Company has been using propane for the last 30 years, and they have 6 fleets
here in Oregon.
You don't know how long it's been here in Oregon. That's correct.
We can find out.
But we'd be happy to follow up with you on that.
Well, your testimony, I was led to believe that they converted here in Oregon 30 years ago, but I guess that's not correct.
When I talked to their fleet owner, they said they had been using propane for the last 30 years, but he didn't specify if that was throughout the whole U.S. or here specifically in Oregon. He said they had 30 years of experience working with propane.
No.
Any other questions for these witnesses? All right. Thank you very much, ladies.
Thank you.
Anybody else would like to testify on Senate Bill 488? Okay, seeing none, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 488, and we are going to hear Senate Bill 790 first, since we have a much bigger sign-up sheet for 790. Senator Close, are you okay? Can you come back, or are you in a committee right now? Okay, I'm sorry about that. My staff didn't let me know that. So Since we have a lot of people in here for Senate Bill 790, we will go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 790. That's what I said. So, yeah.
Committee members, Senate Bill 790 establishes the person commits offense of equine tripping if person intentionally causes equine to trip or fall, intentionally ropes or lassos of equine for purposes of rodeo, contest, exhibition, entertainment, or sports event, or as practice for events. Makes the violation of equine tripping a Class B misdemeanor subject to maximum fine of 6 months imprisonment.
Okay, and we have Senator Haas, since your name is on this bill. You want to sit up here and do your testimony?
I'll sit here, yeah.
Okay. All right, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm passing out some written testimony along with a photograph of our horse, Jack, Gentleman Jack, as we call him, with my daughter. We've been active in horse shows, and she competes. I say it's our horse because she competes and I pay the bills. So I became familiar with this subject of horse tripping several years ago, and I've been mystified since then about why this is so difficult for the Oregon legislature to pass. Very simply, horse tripping is the practice of roping the front or hind legs of a galloping horse, causing it to trip and come crashing to the ground. It's done intentionally at fringe rodeos, and points are awarded for dropping the horse. If you haven't seen the photos or the videos of this practice, yes, it's as bad as it sounds. 9 states have already outlawed horse tripping, including Texas, a state that we often associate with rugged cowboys and rodeos. In fact, the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association has banned horse tripping. There is just no denying that roping a horse at its legs so that it crashes into the ground is shockingly cruel. I can't believe that our state still allows this and looks the other way when we know it still exists. These animals typically weigh more than 1,000 pounds, and unlike steer or calves, have a center of gravity that is several feet in the air. The sheer physics of these half-ton creatures crashing onto the ground from that distance is why they're often maimed and injured. And that's why it's been banned on mainstream rodeo circuits and from legitimate Western events. So, committee, there's experts here today to explain why this law is needed, including veterinarians and what I would call the mainstream horse and cowboy community. I should say this won't be the biggest bill that we pass in this legislature or in this committee, but I believe we kind of define ourselves by the small things that we do, and one measure of who we are is how we treat God's creatures. You can see by some of the sponsors on this bill that it's bipartisan. I thank you for indulging me in the committee and look forward to the testimony.
Thank you, Senator. And we also have Representative Gomberg, who would like to testify. Welcome to the committee. This is your first time here. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And thank you, Senator Haas, for introducing this bill. I'm David Gomberg, House District 10 from the Oregon coast. I should tell you, more often than not, I'm in favor of writing fewer laws rather than more laws, and I'm certainly sensitive to when we start looking at changing historical or traditional or cultural kinds of practices. Those are some of the ideas I come here with, but there are exceptions to every rule, and this is certainly one of them, so much so that when I found out the bill had been introduced, I sought out the sponsor to put my name on it. So what are we talking about? You've heard a little bit of information, but we take a young horse, we chase it into a small arena. We snag its front legs, forcing it to fall on its face. And the harder it falls, the more violent the action, the more points you get for doing it. Entertainment. Why don't we just beat the horse with a stick and sell tickets? I mean, really. This is clearly an abusive situation. As the senator indicated, 9 states have outlawed the practice already. We should be the next. And if that weren't enough, then I'd encourage you to also to consider the effect that this has on mainstream or legitimate rodeo. That mainstream rodeo doesn't allow this kind of practice, but there's an element of guilt by association, because when this takes place in isolated or fringe rodeos, the public doesn't sit back and say, well, they're not mainstream, they're not legitimate. They simply say, here's another rodeo practice and it's bad. So this bill in part protects mainstream legitimate rodeo, in addition to the more important task of prohibiting and preventing a clearly abusive kind of practice. So I thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or we can defer to the experts behind me.
Okay. Thank you. We'll see if there's any questions for either of the sponsors. You want to cross-examine him from up here? Or
no? Yeah, if you don't mind. Senator Haas, I remember 2 years ago we had the equine tripping bill again, and it was a little broader. This is this a little narrower as defined than it was 2 years ago?
I believe it is. I think it's pretty simple. It's a third of a page. I mean, compared to the bill we just heard, it's kind of refreshing in its simplicity. And I generally favor laws like that are simple and plain.
I'd just like to say that the bill from 2 years ago, as I remember it, also included the Cowboys were concerned because they couldn't handle the horses, et cetera, et cetera. But this is very clear. It's just related to rodeos and exhibitions, et cetera, and not to the guy out in the range someplace.
Madam Chair, if I may, Senator, you're absolutely on point here. The bill deals only with entertainment activities and does not address range activities, animal management issues, and I think in particular doesn't speak to accidental tripping of horses, but rather the intentional and entertainment-oriented tripping of horses.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Great. Any other questions, Senator Hansel?
Well, being from the district that's home of the penalty roundup, my question is, it's the devils are in the details, but after a bucking event, there are times where it's difficult to get the horse herded out of the arena. And so the pickup cowboys lasso and bring that horse over to the gate to allow them to go in. That's one of the ways they control them, about the only way they can control them on occasion. Does this bill, it says intentionally ropes or lassos, well, it says legs there. Normally they don't do the legs, but occasionally the rope slips over and it does catch a leg. And it's at a rodeo, it's at a contest. There were entertainment. But it's the only way we can get the, they're not tripped per se, but they are lassoed. And I'm wondering if, think that's the intent, but I'm worried about
it. Do you have the answer to this, or we can try to find somebody who
can? I'm certain that is not the intent, and I'm looking at the bill here to see how, it says intentionally ropes or lassoes the legs for purpose of a rodeo contest exhibition. So, that's certainly not the intent here. I want to just follow up on that. I married a Pendleton girl, and so we go to the roundup all the time. And
you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, and we're rodeo fans. We've gone to the Malala Rodeo, and the St. Paul's Rodeo is a 4th of July tradition in our family. And if I thought this in any way was somehow making inroads and somehow harming rodeos or that sport, I wouldn't be here. So, thank you.
Any other questions for the sponsors? Thank you very much, Representative, and thank you for bringing this bill forward to us today for discussion.
Thank you all for the time today.
Great. Thank you. We have two people that came from over 100 miles away to testify today, and we typically call them up first. So I noticed that you're both on the same side of the issue. I was going to say it doesn't mean that you're necessarily on the same side of the issue when you're sitting together, but today you are. Russ Mead and John Cox. And anybody else that came from over 100 miles today would like to come up and testify. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming from far away here to share your views. And if you can, state your name for the record, please, so we know.
Sure, I've got some visuals here, too. So
okay, do you want to get started while he's getting that going? Yeah.
Well, my name's John Cox. I'm a born and raised Oregonian. I've been on ranches my entire life. I've had horses of my own probably since 16 or 15 years old. I went into the military in Oregon. I'm a disabled Vietnam veteran. And I got to say, this horse tripping situation is not good. It's the rodeo, and I just can't believe a rodeo circuit would go down that road and that kind of thing as far as the abuse and that kind of thing. So if there's any questions, I'm not a veterinarian or anything. I'm just a typical guy and that kind of thing that owns horses, and I don't want to see this.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Sure. Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair, senators. My name is Russ Mead. I'm a animal rights lawyer. I
I'm also an adjunct professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, which is my main connection with this state. I live in Seattle, Washington. One of the things that I heard last time that this bill came around was we really shouldn't be that concerned about it because this doesn't happen. And because the Professional Rodeo Association has outlawed it, we were hearing, well, why should we spend time on it? Well, this does happen almost every weekend somewhere in the summer. And so last July 7th, 2012, I drove to Burns, Oregon at the Harney County Fairgrounds, a public facility, and took photographs of the horse roping event. I will also say that it was very difficult to get these photos, that the rodeo organizers did everything they possibly could to stop me from getting even these still photos. They absolutely did stop me from getting videos. So this is a first slide that's been put into a YouTube video that's gotten several thousand reviews and lots of comments, as you would expect, saying that this is cruel. So the event starts with the horse riders chasing this horse. Of course, this is a flight animal, and they take off afraid. The first contestant ropes the horse around the neck, in this case, driving the horse's head into the dirt. The second slide that I've got shows another problem with this roping. In this particular case, after the rodeo contestant roped the horse around the neck, actually stopped the horse, put the rope around the pommel, pulled back, and was putting pressure on the horse, you could actually hear this horse wheezing all of the way across the arena, a gasping sound, you know, looking for air. I wish I could have helped this horse, but of course this is still legal in this state, so there's nothing that anybody could have done. The second rider then ropes the horse's legs. This shot is blocked. Again, there was officials trying to stop me from taking these photos, so that's why the horse's head is blurred out. In this particular event, they wanted the horses to be roped by the hind legs, but this contestant wasn't that skilled, got the front legs instead. I will say it was amazing to get a shot of the rope while it was, you know, being thrown and being able to capture this to show that they are really roping these horses' legs. And the next thing that happens is why we're here. The horse has now got a rope around its neck. It's got a rope around its hind legs. In theory, time is called and the event is over, but what really happens as a practical matter is these horses come crashing to the ground, and sometimes spectacular crashes like this. And in my view, and in the view of virtually everybody who's seen the YouTube video that where I've pasted this together, folks are saying that this is not a sport. This is animal cruelty. So we would, certainly Animal Law Coalition, myself, folks that support horses, would like to see this moved out of committee. This is an event that should be banned here. If the professional rodeos themselves ban this, the state of Oregon should ban it as well. Thank you for your time, and I would answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
I would just say I appreciate you coming here. In one sense, I wish you could show that video. On the other hand, I'm glad you're not. It's pretty graphic. It's frankly pretty disturbing. And so I appreciate you in presenting this in a
That was the intent. I wanted to just show the facts. These are just photographs. For my external materials, I've given an 8x10 of each of these shots and have submitted them if anybody's curious.
We did pass those around. Thank you. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Mead, you said that professional rodeos have banned them, but yet you have pictures of apparently a rodeo going on. Is this not a professional rodeo?
Well, it's the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. So this is basically a trade association for the largest of the rodeos, you know, the Pendletons, the places that we know of large scale. Those folks have outlawed it, and it's not a rodeo event. It's these smaller rodeos. It's the ranch rodeos. It's these rural rodeos that still have it because they're not a member of the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association.
Senator Hansel.
For clarity, I think it is not a PCRA, Pro Rodeo Cowboy, sanctioned event. It's not like bareback riding or something. There are no national champions. It's not an event that you get points at. And that's
just a follow-up. Mr. Cox, I'd like to thank you for your service to our nation.
Amen.
And apparently you are opposed to this horse ripping?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Just one brief question. Would cowboys ever do this on the range? And I know this just is related to rodeos and stuff, but cowboys wouldn't take this action on a horse on the range, would they?
Not the horses. You know, horses are a tool on a ranch. You don't go stick a knife in your tire and flatten the tire before you drive it, especially if you have to get to work. I mean, it's just not done, and most of us are appalled at this whole situation.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yep. Any other questions? All right. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you very much for your time today
to share your testimony with us. Mitzi Bolanos and Sarah Sellen Eiler. Did I get that right?
I'd actually never heard of it. I've raised horses for 40 years.
Actually, and Sharon Harmon. Why don't I call up Sharon as well? Sharon here?
Stunned.
It's cruel.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here today.
Yeah.
And I should have mentioned, if you do have written testimony, just you can hand that in, and she will pass it out to us. So whoever wants to go first. Mitzi, did you want to go first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mitzi Bolaños. I'm an attorney. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here in support of a Senate Bill 790 banning horse tripping. This bill would make Oregon the 12th state to ban this cruel practice. The first was Rhode Island in 1989, over 20 years ago, followed by California in 1994, Texas and New Mexico in 1995, Oklahoma and Illinois in 96, Maine in 98, Florida in 99, Nebraska in 2008, Arizona 2009, and most recently Kansas in 2011. The people of Oregon care just as much about their horses as the people in these states. We care just as much about the broken backs, the broken necks, the broken legs, even the deaths that is caused by these horse tripping events. As we saw, the rodeo associations outlaw this, and it's still happening right here in this state, a state with a long history of respecting and protecting its horses. And I urge the committee to continue that tradition of protecting and respecting Oregon's horses and vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Sharon?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society. We are a private agency unaffiliated with any other national or local group. I cannot even begin to compare my testimony to that of Senator Haas's and Representative Gomberg's. Thank you for your eloquent and impassioned plea to stop this practice. This is entertainment. This isn't a livestock management tool. This isn't the slippery slope. My testimony has a photograph that I didn't pull off an animal rights website. It's off of OregonLive.com, and it shows a horse flipping on its head. I would like us to join, I can't believe I'm saying this, Texas, Kansas, and Nebraska in this animal welfare issue. Thank you for your support. We appreciate your attention to this matter.
Great.
Thank you.
Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. Excuse me, I am incredibly nervous.
That's okay. We are too, so.
It's your place. Don't worry about it.
So my name is Sarah Selleniler. I am a small business owner in Portland, Oregon, and I am also a horse owner and lifelong equestrian. I grew up around rodeos and have a great respect for the American rodeo tradition. I hope to share some of my personal history to let you know why I'm here in strong support of SB 790 and why I feel it's important for Oregon to stop this terrible practice of tripping horses for sport and recreation. I have felt a close connection with horses since I was a very small child. When I was growing up, I had severe learning disabilities to the point where I really couldn't read fully until 6th or 7th grade. School was a nonstop struggle for me, so I grew up incredibly insecure. And having a barn to go to and horses to ride really gave me something to actually be confident about. Where I was rewarded for my hard work, and not only that, but horses taught me responsibility, tenacity, how to build a relationship, respect, compassion, the lesson to never quit, why I'm here with terrible stage fright, and most importantly, how to care for something other than myself. Having all these experiences as a child was a true gift, but the most important lesson I learned was to respect those who are without a voice and still do as you ask, even if they have no choice in the matter. Horses are completely reliant on humans for food, for water, for a home. Sensitivity and compassion are key to having a successful and rewarding relationship with such an animal. So after my lifetime of over 20 years holding these animals in such high regard, I hear and see horse tripping, and it brought me to tears. Horses got me through some of the hardest times in my life, and it is so disappointing and so hard for me to comprehend why a practice would even be in existence. But the fact is that it does happen here in Oregon, both in so-called ranch rodeos in eastern Oregon and in Torito rodeos, which are Mexican rodeos, in the Portland area. Horse tripping is not practiced in mainstream rodeos sanctioned by the PRCA. It does not happen in the Pendleton Roundup, the St. Paul Rodeo, does not happen in the Sisters Rodeo, or any of the other major rodeos in Oregon. Small groups of individuals get together and hold their events away from public view. They chase young horses, often yearlings if you've heard, into the arena, and after they rope their front legs out from underneath them, they cause them to crash headfirst into the dirt. These young horses too often suffering crippling injuries and are so psychologically traumatized that often they can never bring themselves to trust people again. SB 790 is not intended to affect mainstream rodeo in any way. Many of the states that have banned horse tripping are cowboy states, as Sharon said, that still enjoy a strong rodeo tradition. This bill is not intended to interfere with legitimate roping that occurs on ranches and farms. It only applies to equines or members of the horse family, and it only applies to horse tripping that happens for recreation or sport. Horses have fought wars for us. They've transported us for hundreds of years, and now they deserve to be treated with at least half the decency that we treat one another. Please don't let these amazing animals go to waste.
Thank you. You did beautifully.
Thanks.
Nice. Thank you.
This is terrible.
Except you've elevated Senator Haas to the chair, so which is okay.
It's okay.
Oh, what am I supposed to do?
I'll take care of him later. Any questions for any of these ladies? Senator Olson.
Ms. Selenheiler, that was moving testimony, and you did a great job. And ma'am, your picture about the horse landing on his noggin, it just crushes you.
Mm-hmm. So, Sharon, I do have a question for you. I saw that this is a Class B misdemeanor. So would this fall under the rest of our animal abuse statutes?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, yes, it would.
Okay. And yes, so enforcement would be through a complaint basis, somebody to call the sheriff. This doesn't involve the Department of Agriculture.
No, any law enforcement agency of the state could enforce this law.
Including the Humane Society?
The Oregon Humane Society could, and like all other law enforcement agencies in the state, we are a complaint-driven process. We don't go looking for trouble. Unfortunately, it finds us.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Just a sort of a clarity, not a question, probably a statement. You know, my family and I have raised horses for over 40 years and bred them, and I've delivered a couple the hard way sometimes, and I've shoveled a lot of barns, so I'm pretty familiar with horses. We do occasionally rope a horse, not trip it and not put it on its legs, but around its neck. And usually we do that when the horse is panicking or in trouble, and we do that to calm them down and to get them under control. But we don't yank on them. We don't choke them. We just use it as a control effort, and we do it very gently. And quite often, many horses, if you just put a rope around their neck, not even looped all the way over, just lay it over the top of their neck, they will calm down for you. Just hold it with your hand down below. It's a way of controlling an animal and giving it some reassurance. But this is just completely off the wall, this stuff is. And I don't know, you know, people who have horses love those horses. I think sometimes they love the horses more than they do other people in their lives, and probably for good reasons. And I'm amazed. I didn't know about this till a year ago, and I'd raised horses for 40 years, you know, down in Eagle Point. I was just stunned. I just couldn't believe people were doing this. I did have a horse that tripped a lot. He did it on purpose when I was on him. he didn't scare the hell out of me.
I was going to say, I'm not sure self-inflicted tripping is included in this bill, but thank you for sharing your thoughts, Senator. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, ladies. Appreciate your testimony and for coming here today. I see Representative Bentz, did you want to testify in this bill today? This is horse tripping, not bison.
Yes. Good.
Or if you want to testify on both, we can
welcome. No, that's fine. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Cliff Benz, District 60. The Jordan Valley Rodeo is in my district, and they have what's called the Big Loop Contest. They've had it for many, many years, and it started out as a rodeo that was intended to show people how horses are managed in eastern Oregon. I have brothers that raise horses. They have a horse sale each year and sell about 30 head. And on occasion, they will have to rope a horse by the front feet out in the sagebrush because there's no other way to manage the horse. And this is a practice that is of long-term duration and one that is common when there's no other way to manage the horse. This big loop contest for Jordan Valley has become a economic godsend to that area. And they have developed rules and installed practices that protect the horse to the greatest extent possible. And that includes many different things that they've done. One is to make sure that the saddle horn cannot be, it has to be slick. They have other means of protecting the horse. However, if you're going to rope a horse by the front feet, on occasion, a horse is going to be hurt. And this is true with any management of any animal. At some point, there's going to be some damage to that animal, maybe. That's the nature of the interaction of man and animals, I guess. This bill raises the issue of practices that in the past were absolutely accepted. And as time has passed, they have become less so. And I would implore the committee to consider carefully its decision today and how it impacts folks who view many of these practices as still necessary and a technique, indeed, that's necessary outside. Now, whether it's right for exhibition purposes or not is up to your committee to decide. I'll simply say that if people stack a horse on its head, they shouldn't be engaged in that practice. That is wrong. And so the pictures you have seen may well reflect the practice of those who should have known better and should have been prosecuted for that which they did. That's not any way to treat a horse. Now, you may wonder, I've never roped a horse by the front feet. I've roped many horses. I grew up on a ranch. We each had three or four horses of our own, and we would use them every day when in alternate days because it's hard work. And just as Senator Bates says, those animals were the closest friends we have. We would do nothing to hurt them. Nothing. And the nature of our area of the state, however, is difficult, challenging, and rough. Now, this means that if this committee decides that for exhibition purposes this shouldn't be done, that's your choice. But for everyday management of animals in the range, I would say we need to still have this ability because many times there's no other way to manage the horse. I'll simply say when you're not in an exhibition circumstance, you do your best not to have to rope a horse. It's not the preferred method. And that's all I have to say, Senator.
Thank you very much, Representative, for sharing your thoughts. And you probably know that the bill is limited to entertainment purposes. But we certainly appreciate your comments.
Thank you. If I may say, my understanding of the bill is that it also precludes practicing for such a event. And I would simply say, again, we don't generally call what we do, what my family does or what other people do when they're forced to rope a horse outside practice. We do it because one has to. And I'll also simply say that many of the people that engage in the big loop contest or otherwise are people off ranches that do have to rope horses on occasion by the front feet outside. And one could argue that the practice at the Jordan Valley Rodeo is indeed a practice. Excuse me, the exhibition at the Jordan Valley Rodeo is indeed practice. One can make that argument. Now, whether that was true or not, you'd have to talk to the folks that are roping, because some of them may not be people that live on ranches and have to actually rope horses by their front feet.
Well, and the way that I read it is as practice for a rodeo contest, exhibition, entertainment, or sport. So it's not practiced in a separate context. Right. So that's the way that I read that bill. So anyway, we'll see if there's any questions before you run away.
Sure.
We never pass on the opportunity to question a representative.
Happy to hear it.
Any questions for Representative Benz? Senator Hash.
Thank you, Representative Benz, for your thoughtful comments, as always. You did make a comment that if somebody does something and drops a horse on its head, that's wrong and they should be prosecuted.
I did.
That's impossible to do without this language. Like that. So I think that's what we're getting at, not for management tools, not for something that's not deemed entertainment. So that's what we're trying to get to.
Chair McFeller, Senator, I'm not sure if I agree with you on whether they cannot currently be prosecuted. Maybe they're not being prosecuted, but I'm not sure that the law precludes it.
So, yeah, I was going to say you're probably thinking under animal abuse statutes, which, yeah, we'd have to take a look at that. But
right.
Thank you very much for sharing your comments today. We do appreciate you coming in. Okay, we have a few more people signed up that'd like to testify. David Aiken. Is David here? Kai Kilgore. Kay? And Jim Walsh also signed up. Okay, Jim? Okay. Mr. Aiken, would you like to go first? Thank you for coming here today. Share your thoughts.
I'm appearing in opposition to this bill, Madam Chairperson.
Can you state your name for the record?
David Franklin Aiken, A-I-K-E-N.
Thank you.
First of all, citation has been made about Texas. Well, Texas says that the Bible should be taught in science class is the truth. And one of the senators from Texas on the federal level said he didn't believe in meteorites. So I would prefer that we not use Texas as an example.
So noted for the record.
The bill name is incorrect. The purpose is not to trip the horses. The purpose is to rope them, and they're roped by the front feet rather than the hind feet, because roping them by the hind feet damages the horses. Consequently, the buckaroos and the cowboys engaged in this action are particularly careful to rope valuable livestock, horses which are necessary for the operation of a ranch, by the front feet. To do so is a great skill. If one were to attend a ranch rodeo where ranch cowboys and buckaroos compete against one another, it is a skill competition and a very important activity in order to run a ranch and in order to be able to manage horses. A large portion of the state of Oregon is in the Great Basin Desert. This activity was a traditional and is a traditional activity among Great Basin buckaroos, and the skill to rope horses as carefully as possible because of their economic value is extremely important. I have attended a number of rodeos, ranch rodeos, and they're called ranch rodeos, by the way, because they involve real buckaroos and cowboys in eastern Oregon, and I have had the privilege in a number of cases of working those rodeos. I've allowed my horse to be used in those ropings, and I would never have done so if I thought the horse was going to be damaged. That is my personal observation. I want to emphasize again that one of the witnesses testified about horses being roped by the front legs rather than the rear. Horses are never roped by the rear legs because of the damage to the horse and the economic loss. This bill would work a considerable economic hardship on the hardworking people in Jordan Valley, Burns, Polina, Paisley, Halfway, McDermott, and other towns in eastern Oregon. It is not usual for the committee, subcommittees and committees of this legislature to hold hearings elsewhere. The reason why there are not a lot of people appearing in opposition to this bill from those venues is because this is calving season. And I would hope that the scheduling of this hearing at the time that calving season has been held was mere chance. I would also remind the Democratic members of the legislature that our party is in minority in eastern Oregon. We don't need to identify with a bill that very definitely discriminates against those small, hardworking communities in that portion of the state. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions up to my ability to do so, since I am not a regular resident of that portion of the state.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming here to share your testimony. Why don't we hear from everyone else, and we'll see if there's any questions. Thank you.
My name is Kay Kilgore. I live in Portland now, but I was born in La Grande, Oregon, lived several years in Union, Oregon, and my family lives in Pendleton now. I've attended rodeos basically since I was out of diapers, and I had to ask what horse tripping was, too, because I had never seen it at a rodeo. The rodeo in Union is a PRCA rodeo. And as it was pointed out, that is a trade. If a rodeo is sanctioned by the PRCA, the cowboys get points and can go to the national finals. What I have seen about horse tripping is appalling. I worked at the racetrack for almost 20 years as a paramedic, and it doesn't take a rope to break a horse's leg. I have never seen at PRC rodeos intentional tripping of horses. I've seen lots of roping. I've seen the pickup men rope horses to take them back to where they belong, and they're extremely careful not to crash the horse down. An injured horse is difficult to get out of the arena. They have to bring in equipment. I've also seen horses that actually enjoy their job at rodeos. The timed event horses are well kept. They're well trained, and I'm just hoping that we join the other states, the PRCA, the American Quarter Horse Association, and the movie and TV people in banning horse tripping for entertainment.
Thank you for your testimony. Jim, you get the last word today. Doesn't happen very often.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Jim Welsh here for Oregon Cattlemen Association. And, of course, we addressed this in 2011 also. There wasn't a hearing on this particular bill, but we have some concerns, and even with the photography that was used here, it would have been better to have had rolling footage so we could really take a look at the beginning to the end of an event here. We're very concerned that this would eventually infringe on our ability to do some very necessary good animal husbandry techniques that have been with us, as I understand, for over 100 years. And so I have heard from a number of cattlemen who definitely love all their animals and care for them, especially their horses, because they are a tool that they have to have. If they're not on an ATV, but if they're on horseback, and if they do have themselves, a number of them have horses that they raise, and they have to do a special technique, as I understand, that does involve the front legs. And it's done very carefully. And in these events, these rodeos, as you heard from Mr. Aiken, the ranch rodeos I have heard a lot about, and certainly the Jordan Valley and the Burns Rodeo. And so we're very concerned unintended consequences could develop from this particular bill. And it would cause, I think, some definite economic hardship on some of these smaller communities also, and then eventually spill over onto our ability to rope any of our livestock, cattle included. And so our concern is that if you're going to, as Representative Bentz provided you, as you have the authority to make a decision on whether it's an event that you're going to ban, that's your decision. But I think we have to make that very, very carefully. We haven't heard from everyone involved in this issue. So I plead with you that we would extend the hearing. I think we have some tribal members, Hispanic rodeos, others to be heard from throughout the state, especially from the east side. We only had 2 days to respond when this bill was put up for a hearing. It's not easy to get people that are very busy on the east side over here in a short period of time.
So, Mr. Welsh, a couple of things I just want to get on the record. We do accept a written testimony. The other is if at any time anybody would like to call in.
Right.
We do not require that they drive out here. That is definitely a hardship. And so, you can always request from the committee staff that anybody that can't make it here is welcome to call in. But we certainly will continue to accept written testimony. Okay. I think Senator Hass had a question.
Well, thank you. I was just, the bill is so short and so simple. I'm just wondering, Jim, where you're reading anything having to do with cattle at all, anywhere, in this bill.
Unintended consequences that could develop. You know, it's. I know what you're intending here, and I think that's laudable. We don't want these animals hurt, and that could be an unintended consequences of the rodeo or the event. And I, talking to an awful lot of cattlemen and those involved in rodeo, our son, almost 20 years involved in rodeo, and he said, Dad, he said, this is a very important technique necessary on the ranch. So we don't want interference with that ability to use that technique. So we want to make sure this language is right, is correct.
Madam Chair, I just want to say that I think we're being as clear as we possibly can to peg this to entertainment, rodeo, contest, exhibition, or sport for a rodeo, and it mentions equine. It doesn't matter cattle, and it specifically says it has to be intentional, not ranching practices or farm tools. And so I'm not sure how we could be more clear here to guard against unintended consequences.
Madam Chair, respectfully, may I ask a question?
Actually, we don't have the witnesses ask questions.
Right.
Certainly, if you wanted to respond to that, you can. Would you like to respond to what he just said?
No, I was unaware that you allowed telephone testimony, and I was going to ask if I could excuse myself, make a telephone call, and if you could give me the number, I may be able to get somebody to testify.
Well, at this point, we're going to be closing the public hearing. However, they can certainly write in, and all you have to do is email testimony in, and we forward that to all the committee members to make sure that they see it. And I know that my committee members read all of the testimony that comes in.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
But we do appreciate, and we are not having a work session today. Our committee doesn't meet until next week again, so certainly they have lots of time to send that in. So if you want to go ahead and get the
word
out.
As was suggested, will you be holding another hearing on this bill?
We will not at this time. But again, if you send it in, it'll get in the public record. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, yeah. you will be getting to a letter from the Oregon Veterinarians Association in support of this legislation.
Okay. All right. And is there anything else that you want to mention about the public testimony, Bill?
Madam Chair, I think that's it. And then it's also, in addition to that, available online through the OLA system.
Yes, and that is posted online, too, so other people can see it as well. Senator
I do. Mr. Yeah. Welch, just a clarification. Is your concern more that it's in the rodeo arena or that it's in the ranch format?
Really both, because, you know, the ranchers and historically, the culture and customs around ranching have supported rodeo. And certainly we wouldn't want it to spill over into everyday need for managing their livestock. So,
Follow up.
My understanding and listening to testimony is that most ranchers don't intentionally go out there and trip their horses to get them to do something. So I'm just kind of wondered, what your concern is, because it's just specifically for exhibition or contests and not for the ranch itself. Are you concerned that this will eventually grow and spread? Because we have laws that have a tendency to get bigger than they were. Are you concerned that it will spill over into the ranch and the techniques on the ranch?
I think that has been passed on to me as a concern. Camel's nose under the tent.
That's, thank you.
You know, and whether that can be derived from this language or not, it is definitely a concern to those in the business of raising livestock. So.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony today, and thank you for coming here today to share your testimony. Certainly, if folks want to email in, we'll make sure you have the committee chair's email before you leave.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Anybody else like to testify on this bill before we close the public hearing? Okay. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 790. I'm having a hard time with the numbers today. For folks listening, we closed the public hearing on Senate Bill 790. We're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 503. We are moving from horses to bison. That was sort of a joke. Okay. Beth, you want to tell us a little bit about we're growing our animal size here? You know, we need a little levity. It's the end of the day.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 503,
you said camels.
It makes laws governing the handling of stray animals applicable to bison.
Yes. Is John Lindsay here? And Senator, we're just waiting for Senator Close, who is Bill.
Right,
yes,
outside.
Senator Close. We need to rope her in here. Oh, sorry. Thank you for coming back. And I apologize. I had said to my staff that we had a lot of people in the room for the horse tripping bill, so we were going to do that first, but I think we got our communications line crossed. So thank you for coming up. Gentlemen, I was going to have Beth do a little introduction on the bill, so we're all ready to go. Thank you, Senator. It's all yours.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelter and members of the committee. I'm Senator Betsy Close. At first glance, Senate Bill 503 might remind you of a well-known song, Home, Home on the Range. But in actuality, this bill addresses a real problem for some communities. Large livestock left unattended and allowed to roam at large can come into conflict with modern society. Current statute does not provide a mechanism for law enforcement to cite those who fail to properly restrain their bison. We do have those in Linn County. This is what happened in Linn County. At least four other counties are affected where bison are around. We still have open range laws and private lands that are fenced. Currently, the Department of Agriculture has authority to determine the adequacy of the fence should cattle or equines trespass. It's my understanding that due to a technical issue with the scientific classification of bison, they are not included with cattle in the definition of as stray animals. This bill would add bison to the list of stray animals that the law describes in I've got ORS 607.007, but we're told by Department of Ag, who I'm working with, that it's 607.004.
Yes.
So we're going to need an amendment to get it in 5-4?
5-7.
Okay.
Everyone's having trouble.
We're
going
to need an amendment to get it in the right slot.
It's the end of the day. We're tired.
And we would appreciate your consideration.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Thank you. I'm really tired today. Thank you, Senator Close. I was just looking up the statute as you were talking to have that in front of me. So thank you for being here today, Commissioner.
Yes, Senator, I'm John Lindsay, and I'm one of the county commissioners for Linn County. And I just would like to give you a little background on the situation that we have here. As we know, agriculture in Oregon is very diverse, very robust, And somewhere along the line, we decided that we would start having clean, healthy meat and start raising more bison. The problem is bison are very large animals, and they have to be well cared for, as with horses or cattle or anything else of that nature. Sometimes we have found that there are people that get involved with the raising of these animals that aren't quite equipped to handle the animals that they're starting to raise. And on several occasions, we have had to have law enforcement try and round up animals. I mean, it's not the old days when we had the sheriff riding around on horses, but that actually has happened on occasion where we have to get out the posse and go try and round up animals. And the last go-around was 7 days. And that gets a little excessive for law enforcement to be involved with trying to protect the public from large animals that are at large that literally just walk through regular cattle fences and buildings. So during the large problem that we had a couple of years ago, it was indicated to me that one of the, several cattle growers in the area wanted something done about this. And I had talked to state regulators and police, and basically there's no mechanism to handle buffalo. Well,
no,
I don't think I'm
bison.
Supposed to use the term buffalo.
I was going to say, yes, no
large.
Trespass bison.
Yes. And so what the result was that I have to do a little confession here, is that there's language that we arrived at, and, of course, I sent a letter to Senator Close and said this is what we need to do, and I wasn't paying attention when this bill got drafted. It got mailed back to me. I never looked at it. And this is not what was mailed to Legislative Council.
That
it
never,
actually was supposed
that
to be...
That never happens.
It was supposed to be just before that. If you go to 607-005-4, there is a listing of what is considered livestock. And livestock is what's on a closed range, which is what we're talking about here. Open range is totally a different set of regulations and laws. And it was indicated to me that you're going to hear shortly from the deputy director, Lisa Hansen, about this, that somehow this got drafted a little bit not quite how we should have it. And the way we want is the bottom line is to define these closed range bison, which are being raised, as livestock animals, so therefore we can treat them just like we do with horse owners or cattle owners or goats or sheep. There's a whole laundry list on that line there of what we can regulate as a livestock animal, so that we can keep those owners as responsible as cattle growers and horse growers. I didn't even know what horse tripping was until I walked in this room. I've been around them all my life. but just to go along that line, that this is, to me, it's just a simple thing, simple fix.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. We have Lisa Hansen from the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and we are going to be calling Roger Huffman. Do you want to explain
sure.
the what your role is in all of this, Lisa?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director. Department of Agriculture. So to go along the confessions route, I am not the expert in this area at all, but we're going to get Roger Huffman, who is our expert, on the phone to help us sort through what we need to do to address the issue.
So he's your stray animal expert?
You, Roger.
Yeah. Hi, Roger. This is Senator Dingfelder calling from the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee in Salem, and thank you for agreeing to call in today. And can you state your name for the record and tell us where you're calling from and who you work for?
Yeah, I'm Roger Huffman, work for Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I'm calling in. Currently, I'm in Ontario.
Okay, thank you. And we were just, we heard a little bit of introduction from Senator Close and Linn County Commissioner about this issue. If you could provide us a little bit of background and your thoughts on the proposed legislation, although there is an amendment that would, and I don't know if you were listening to the testimony. Were you online listening?
No, I was not. Sorry.
Okay. So what was discussed was that there's actually a different bill that will be, or an amendment coming forward, because it was not drafted as intended. But if you could give us a little bit of background on the program and what can be done to manage a stray bison, that would be helpful.
Okay. Well, yeah, bison have been a challenge for a long time, just because their ability to need a a much stronger fencing situation for producers to keep them in. And then secondarily, once they're out and roaming, you know, more of a human health risk, or excuse me, human safety risk, you know, a challenge for those that have maybe normal fencing. They can't deal with them even if they did want to hold them or in some way keep them trapped until the owner can get at them. So it's been an ongoing challenge from that perspective, and many counties have dealt with it in different ways. This particular bill, I'm sorry I didn't hear any amendments, but this in the current form would certainly cause the people that don't have bison to erect a fence that would be adequate, which is much more significant fence than a cow or an equine fence would be. So it does in some way shift the burden to the non-buffalo owners and away from the buffalo owners to keep their animals in a adequately fenced area.
So here's a question for you. How do you control bison?
Well, the best thing is, of course, to have an enclosure that's significant enough that they don't get out.
Use a 30.
And if this bill was like, for example, they turned the other way around, wherein it said something where open range does not apply to buffalo anywhere in the state, then the fencing issue and the burden to keep them on their land would be to the owners of the buffalo. Where it's not clear in statute now, it would make it very clear that responsibility is to that person that wants to keep them. No different if you had a tiger or something more significant, that it is not the burden of the other people to keep them out, but it's the burden of people who want them to keep them in.
Okay, we have a question from Senator Hansel.
Roger,
from the Pendleton area.
Yeah, Roger, Senator Bill Hansel, formerly a county commissioner. My remembrance from dealing with this issue on the county level, you basically have open range where the philosophy is you have to fence the livestock out of your property. But if you have an animal control district, then the owner of the livestock has to fence their livestock in. So by dealing with an open range here, your suggestion outlined on open range, but I don't know what the status of Linn County is, if they have a livestock control district, and if they do, then, you know, some of that issue is taken care of. But my goodness, if you had to fence out a bison, you got to have railroad ties, rebar. We have live, you know.
Fence won't do it.
No. And you ask, how do you control them? Right. With great difficulty, yeah. Because they are strong, big, and they go where they want to go. And those bison raisers in our area have 8x2 fencing. I mean, it's like, you know, literally like herding elephants, because they are so strong and so big, and basically go where they want if you don't have the right fencing. So we've got to make sure this law doesn't require the non-bison owner to fence out the bison. It's unworkable if it is.
Well, we're seeing a lot of nodding going on here that you can't see right now unless you're watching us. But Commissioner, did you want to add? It sounds like we're going to have to get an amendment here. Yes.
To answer Bill's or Senator Hansel's question, there is, we have open range in Linn County, but what I was saying was how this got drafted was, and this was brought to our attention real quick, was this is on open range. That was never the intention. We have what's called classified closed range, which is more or less if you go to South Salem here, there's rural properties with, you know, 10 cows on them or whatever. That's a closed range. You have to fence your animals in. And that would be the closed range. I understand what you're talking about with the open range classification, because that's the hog thing, and that really is, I've never been able to figure out what that's all about. But
well, it's, in Eastern Oregon, it prevented people requiring the rancher that has 50,000 acres from having to, or even more importantly, if you're driving along in an open range and you hit livestock, it's your fault, not the livestock's fault. So you got to be real careful. That's a liability issue. But I
right, and it has been handled sometimes, you know, because the statute hasn't been very clear. It's been handled in some cases in a very deadly manner in Umatilla County, as the senator was referring to, when there was 60 buffalo got out just a few years ago up there on Cabbage Hill area.
Really?
And the same issue was that the fences weren't adequate to keep them contained within a certain property owners or anywhere like that. They became roaming the area, and ultimately the sheriff was quoted in the paper as saying that whatever people needed to do, they needed to do to protect themselves and their property. And they started with 60 animals when they got out, and there were 32 when they finally got it gathered. But they couldn't get them gathered until they brought in an elk capture, you know, that ODFW uses for capturing elk. That's how significant the fences had to be, because, like I say, they just don't, we put them in a regular corral, you know, they can jump 6-foot fences fairly easily, and if they're not solid sighted, they can see daylight and they go to it. So I think there's certainly an ability to get something that's useful to deal with this when they get out.
Okay. Any other questions for Roger?
Follow up?
Yes. Follow up?
Roger, I like your idea there, your first part of your comment really struck a chord with me. If we made an amendment that would exempt bison from the open range law of Oregon, that they are required to be pinned, which then would make them required to be pinned. And I think we ought to make something too, you know, domesticated bison, because who knows, we may have a wild herds here someday and we can't fence them in. But bison raised for product, if we exempt them from the open range law, would that, in effect, require the owner to fence them adequately?
It would, yes, I believe that would be correct. And how it's worded, you know, we have to make sure that the wording, you know, was in concert with the other parts of that statute, because it does allow, because there is potentially some people that have an adequate facility that could take them up. So there's currently not a process for that, but if you allow for that process in the statute, but then make sure that you were to exempt them from the open range, I think it certainly would go a long way towards solving the issues. And the other thing is that maybe the ability to do some kind of a citation for chronic issues, which we've had in multiple counties, and like Union County adopted a county ordinance because the state was laws were so unclear. They just basically said they cannot run at large, and they are the responsibility at all times of the owners.
So, Roger, here's what we're going to do. It looks like I have a volunteer from the committee, and that's Senator Hansel, to work with Senator Close and with Lisa Hansen, who I'm sure will be working closely with you to make sure that we get some language that works. It sounds like we need an amendment. It certainly makes sure we meet the needs of the issue that came before us here. And with that, is there any other final questions? Senator Bates.
Senator Ansel, can you deal with the problem of habituated bison for us all?
Yeah, out of with raccoons.
It's an inside joke. I had to be here last week.
All right, any other questions for any of the panelists? Right, thank you very much for bringing this issue forward, and we will look forward to the amendment. And thank you very much, Roger, for calling in. Anybody else like to testify on this bill? I don't see anyone else jumping up. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 503, and we're going to sign off. Roger, thank you. And Beth, anything else for the good of the order today?
Madam Chair, I think that's your full agenda.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, we are adjourned.